This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Alan Trott, Jr. I am in Lubbock, Texas, at Texas Tech University, the Southwest Collection Special Collections Library interview room. Today is March 4th, 2003. It's about 8:26 a.m. Central Standard Time. Mr. Trott, you are in Highlands, North Carolina.
That's correct.
Okay. Why don't we start with some basic biographical information, sir? Why don't you tell us where and when you were born and a little bit about your childhood?
I was born in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. April the 3rd, 1928, and lived in Washington, well, I say Washington, D.C. I was in the suburb of Washington, D.C., really, Hyattsville, Maryland, age of five, I believe, at which time my mother and father separated, and I was relocated to, well, we lived around the Washington area for about another year or so, okay. And then I moved to Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And my mother and I did, mm-hmm. with her parents who were down there. And I lived in Pine Bluff, Arkansas until I was 12, mm-hmm. and then relocated back to Washington, D.C., my mother and I.
Okay.
And in the meantime, I traveled back and forth to see my father and his relatives, some aunts and uncles, every year by train at a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
But that was interesting. My grandfather, he was an employee of the Cotton Belt Railroad in Arkansas,
mm-hmm.
so I got free passes, really.
Okay.
But anyhow, I went back and forth, and so each summer I would spend in Washington down on a farm in Maryland with my aunt and uncle and my father,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually, as I say, we moved back to Washington. I went to school starting in Washington. I think I went to four schools in the first grade. This is the period of time that my mother and father were separating,
mm-hmm.
and then went to Arkansas and went to school there until the sixth grade, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and then moved back to Washington. Didn't finish my school, continued to school in the Washington public school system,
mm-hmm.
and then at the ripe age of 17, I joined the U.S. Coast Guard.
Okay.
It was the last year of the war, World War II,
mm-hmm.
and I joined the U.S. Coast Guard and went to active duty over at Curtis Bay, Baltimore, which is a Coast Guard training station.
Now, were you in high school at this time?
Yes, I was in high school.
Okay.
I finished the 10th grade, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and went in the Coast Guard and stayed there at Curtis Bay for doing the boot camp type, and then got assigned around Christmas of 1945
mm-hmm.
to a patrol escort, they called it,
mm-hmm.
and patrol frigate, really. It was 227 feet long. It was a destroyer escort in the Navy,
mm-hmm.
and the Coast Guard had taken it over, and they were using it as a weather ship, and we would go out to weather stations in the North Atlantic down around Bermuda and over by the Azores up in the ice, and we'd stay on each station for 30 days, and we'd really launch balloons and Ray Winsons and stuff like that off of this ship. Stay out there all kinds of weather. Real experience for a 17-year-old.
I can imagine. How did you take to being on the water?
Well, I was sick. Everybody was sick on that boat
really?
for the first couple days out, and then you eventually get used to it.
Uh-huh.
And so I sort of enjoyed it. I should have mentioned it. When I went up to Washington, when I was living in Arkansas, this aunt and uncle, they had a farm, which was on Chesapeake Bay.
Okay.
So I became very attuned, I guess, to sea legs, I guess you'd say.
Right.
Because he was in the oyster business that's big in Chesapeake Bay.
Okay.
And we used to go out and dig oysters at the right time of the season.
Uh-huh.
And so that I sort of got, that's how I became associated with the Coast Guard, really.
Okay.
I didn't realize I was going to be in the North Atlantic. I thought I'd be, you know, down around Chesapeake Bay, but
right.
I didn't make it there.
Right.
But anyhow, I stayed in, and the war was over, and then they made a, we came back into port. And they said everybody had a certain number of points could get out. Well,
mm-hmm.
it didn't take me long to realize that ninth grade education wasn't going to hack it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got out immediately and went back to high school and
okay.
returned to Washington, D.C. area. My mother had since remarried, and so I went to live with her in Washington and went back to high school and finished high school, I guess, in 1949.
Okay.
And then in 49, I enrolled in the University of Maryland. And went on, stayed in the University of Maryland, and went in advanced ROTC immediately because I didn't have to take basic, being the fact I was a veteran. And went into advanced ROTC and received a regular commission from the Air Force,
okay.
in advanced ROTC.
Let me ask you a couple questions about your childhood. What did your mother do for a living?
My mother worked in a dress store in Washington. She was sort of a clerk in a dress store and later became manager.
Mm-hmm. What are your memories about growing up there, I guess, in Pine Bluff and then back up in Washington?
Well, I remember Pine Bluff is very warm compared to, well, of course, Washington has high humidity.
Right.
And I was very interested in athletics, and I played football and ran track. The junior high school I went to in Washington, D.C., had won the track championship for the town, for the city, for about 17 straight years. So anyone who could walk had to be in track program at the McFarland Junior High School.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that and really enjoyed that.
Okay.
And then when I went on to high school from junior high, of course, having been in track, I continued in track. But then we were strong. That school, particular school I went to, Roosevelt High School, was big in football.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go out for football, naturally.
Okay.
And I did that. And then I went on to the University of Maryland and played a little football out there, too.
Did you? What position did you play?
Well, I was brought up at Maryland. Just a minute.
Hey, sir.
I'm going to break this and say something to my son-in-law.
He's okay, go right ahead.
Interrupt you.
Okay, go ahead, sir. Well, let me ask you, what kind of jobs did you have in your childhood? Did you
work? Man. Well, my father owned a grocery store,
mm-hmm.
and in College Park, Maryland. I guess that's the reason I went to Maryland.
Okay.
And he owned a grocery store, and I worked in that grocery store ever since I could put on an apron. You know,
mm-hmm.
even though my mother and father separated, when I'd come up in the summer, I'd stay with my uncle who was in business with my father,
mm-hmm.
and then I would work in the grocery store, and then I would work on the boat when they'd go out. You know, raking oysters, we called it,
right.
And doing things like that. But I worked primarily in the grocery store. I guess that's where I made my $6 a week. I remember that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's how I really got associated with University of Maryland, because we had a very personalized grocery business where we delivered and put the meat in the refrigerator and stuff like that for people,
right.
Had keys to everybody's houses. And a lot of these customers were, of course, he ran a big credit business, were college professors there at the University of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how I really became associated with Maryland.
So did you kind of grow up a Maryland fan of sports? And
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I guess I have. Yeah, I still watch them on basketball.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get up there as often as I should.
Right.
I haven't been to any homecomings or things like that, but I went to one fraternity reunion down in Solomon's Islands, Maryland,
mm-hmm.
One of my fraternity brothers had. So that's about the only association I've had with the school since I left there. I graduated in 1953.
Okay. What kind of student were you growing up in grade school, then in junior and high school?
Well, mediocre,
really?
That way, in junior high and mm-hmm. in high school. And then when I got out of service and went back, I was a much better student, I can tell you
right,
that.
Right.
I think I went from about a 2.2, you'd call it, to about a 3.2 or something like that,
okay.
B, something. And then in college, I played ball for the first 2 years I was there, and I was down around 2.4.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I got hurt, I hurt my thigh, and I've never told the Air Force this, but anyhow, I've hurt my thigh. It was nothing but a big bruise that just never would go away.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did not go out in my junior and senior year, and then my grades went up. And I think I finished with about a 3.2 or something like that.
Okay.
And then I went on. Well, after I went on in the service, I guess I should get back to that. I went on in the service and I went immediately to pilot school.
What prompted you to join the Coast Guard? Let me ask you.
Okay.
About that
well,
real quick.
Okay. What prompted me to go to the Coast Guard? My father was in the service. Everybody was in the service.
Mm-hmm.
The war was going strong, and everybody mm-hmm. could walk was in the service, and
mm-hmm.
that was sort of the mood. Patriotic mood, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't doing that well in school, and so the recruiters in those days used to come around to the schools, you know, and all this stuff. So, and I'd been associated, as I say, with the Coast Guard down in Chesapeake Bay, and then I went ahead and joined the Coast Guard.
Okay.
And I guess it was just I don't know, because everybody else was doing it, I guess.
Right.
And I really wasn't that happy with school and things like that.
Right. What did your mom and dad feel about that?
Well, my father was overseas at the time. He
okay.
was in the service also, and he was overseas at the time. He didn't have much choice in the matter.
Mm-hmm.
Got mad as heck after he found out about it.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother, I just badgered her to death, you know, and she was the type of mother that I could badger, I guess, and,
mm-hmm.
and get away with it. And she went ahead and signed the papers.
Okay. Okay, and you're 17 years old, and you go off to this training. How did you adapt to the Coast Guard training? Was it difficult for you?
Pretty good, I guess. No, pretty good, I guess. I had I had always wanted to be in the military, I guess. When we lived in Washington, one of our many places, John's, which was a Catholic military academy, mm-hmm. and I'd see those guys marching and all that. And I made a lot of friends with them and with the Catholic brothers, the instructors and things like that. So I think the military came from that, too.
Okay.
And I had an uncle. I had two uncles that were in the service, also one in the Navy, my father's brothers, and one in the Marines. And they were sort of role models for me, I guess.
Did you see them when you were growing up or then the summers?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Every summer. They also lived on the farm with my uncle that I lived with. And every summer, I would be really closely associated with them.
Right. Which branch of service was your father in?
He was in the Air Force, Air Corps in those days.
Right.
Army.
Okay. Did he talk to you about his war experiences?
Well, yes, when he came back.
Right.
But then I was out of the service by then, you know.
Okay.
I think that he came back out of the... No, I was out of the service the time he came back, yeah. He was in England and Holland.
Okay. Tell me what you remember most about your Coast Guard days, that brief time you were in the Guard.
Well, I remember being at Curtis Bay and having a lot of guard duty, and Curtis Bay was also a boatyard. They built a lot of wooden boats there. Mm-hmm. And I remember we had... Our guard duty was make sure that the lumber didn't catch on fire, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember those lonely nights of walking the post there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in those days you had a clock you carried around your shoulder, the old night watchman thing, and you had keys at different locations that you'd turn in this clock to prove that you were walking the beat, you know.
Right.
And so, there was no problem. I in fact, enjoyed it. And when went on in, got out on a ship out at sea, I decided to strike what they call strike for navigator. They call it quartermaster.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested in that because I'd done some of that on the Chesapeake Bay, you know. But that was all pilotage out there. You could see
mm-hmm.
all the time, usually. But anyhow, I went in striking as a quartermaster and became a helmsman and worked the helmsman role most of the time I was out to sea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you said you enjoyed your time on the cruise?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed the time. I liked going into the various ports. We'd go into places like Hamilton, Bermuda, and we never went into the Azores. We'd be off the Azores about 150 miles. Then we'd go into Iceland. Reykjavik, Iceland, was one of our big ports that we'd go into, and we'd stay there two or three days while we were refueling and putting on supplies.
Mm-hmm.
We'd stay on these stations 30 days at a time,
okay.
And then we'd be relieved by another ship, and then we'd go into some port to get supplies. And then the other port was a Gentia, Newfoundland, mm-hmm. that we'd go into. But I can't recall having gone into the Azores. I just seemed like to me we just didn't get there.
Right. Okay, and so how long exactly were you in the Coast Guard?
9 months and 21 days.
That's pretty exact. Okay, and so you got out because of the war ended? And
yeah, the war was over. You know, they dropped the bomb on the bombs,
mm-hmm.
I should say, on Japan, and the war was over. And, of course, everybody just was like going like mad to these separation centers to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And we pulled we had had an incident up in the North Atlantic. This is a real experience for a 17-year-old,
mm-hmm.
18 by then, I guess. The ships, we had some terrible seas up off Iceland, and the ship started breaking up part of the keelson, they call it, which is on the side of the ship, really, below the waterline, broke off and started banging against the side of the ship and mm-hmm. put a hole in it. So we started taking on water, and we went into Reykjavik, Iceland. And it was pretty serious. We were about a 27-degree list. 27 degrees doesn't sound like much to you try to stand up,
right.
You know, for days. And this happened on a Thursday morning. We got into Iceland by Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And they repaired the ship. They put in a steel form down in the engine room and then poured concrete in it, believe it or not.
Hmm.
And we brought it back. We thought we were going to get off the ship in Gentia, Newfoundland. Went back into Newfoundland. They did some more work on it. And darn if we didn't bring the ship all the way back to Boston.
Hmm.
And that's where, when they announced to get out, we were all running to get out.
Really?
Yeah, we had enough by then.
Right.
But my main, I sometimes wish I'd stayed in.
Really?
Because I was in a good career field. I wasn't chipping paint anymore or painting and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
The quartermaster does all work in the wheelhouse and
okay.
navigation, shoots the stars and stuff like that.
Right. Okay, and so you get out, and did you get back to high school then?
Oh, yes. I
went
to direct the high school as soon as I could get there.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I think I started summer school. Let's see, I got out in May, I guess, yeah. And I think I started the summer school that next summer.
Okay.
And I had to start, I think I started in the 10th grade, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I just finished the 9th, I think. And anyhow, I went to summer school, night school, and anything I could get.
Mm-hmm.
And in Washington, being a big city, had a lot of those kind of options, you know.
Right.
And I think I ended up going to Tech High School, which was a technical school, but also they taught, you know, the regular academics for college,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm. And you graduated in 1949.
Yeah, graduated finally in 1949, yeah.
What were your favorite subjects when you were studying there in high school? Do you remember?
History.
Really?
History, let's see, history and sociology,
mm-hmm.
things primarily dealing with people, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
I wasn't very good at math.
Okay. That. Now, was it a choice for you to go to college, or did your parents both kind of push you that way?
No, it was a choice. No, no, no.
Okay.
No one in my family had ever been to college. In fact, I was somewhat, this is hard to believe in today's world, somewhat chastised by not going into the family business.
Hmm.
And my father ended up selling it mm-hmm. as a result of me not being willing to go in. Although I worked at it in college the whole time.
Now, did you have any brothers and sisters?
No, I'm the only one.
Okay. And so tell me about your experience there at University of Maryland, those 4 years.
Okay, well, I went to Maryland, as I say, on a football scholarship and went out to freshman ball, came up as a quarterback, and then we had some sterling athletes there at that time. I was way out of my league, I mm-hmm. determined real soon. And we had one guy from Baltimore by the name of Jack Scarbuth, who later made All-American.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up the same time I did as a quarterback,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't have any chance, so I started playing defensive cornerback.
Hmm.
So I went to play defensive. That was the beginning of the platoon system.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Tatum, I know you recall that name.
Yes, sir.
From North Carolina, by the way.
Yes, sir.
He was from me. But he was the coach then. And my freshman coach is a guy by the name of Bill Meeks,
mm-hmm.
who's one of the finest gentlemen I've ever been associated with.
Mm-hmm.
He was the freshman coach. So I played ball for them my freshman year and also my sophomore year.
Okay.
And then that's when I got hurt and I didn't show up for practice the rest of the time.
Okay. What were the academics like there for you?
Tough, especially playing ball.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, and I don't know whether they do it now or not, but I would imagine they do, we were very fortunate to have tutors, and I would have never gotten through if I didn't have a strong tutor program.
Really?
Especially in things like English and math, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And I took every science course in the world to avoid as much math as I could, you know, and biology, botany, bacteriology, everything I could get, and zoology, I remember that too. But anyhow, with the tutors, in the first 2 years, I think they sort of shaped me toward being able to study,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we had some excellent tutors. I can remember Shakespeare on an airplane going to ball games, you
really?
Know, stuff like that. They would ride right with us, and
mm-hmm.
I remember the Dr. Mooney was my English tutor, and I would have never gotten through without her.
Mm-hmm.
And then others, too. I had to have a tutor in zoology, but I think all the ball players did, because mm-hmm. all you had to do is name all the parts of the body, you know, and every other body. So, and that was tough. Memory span was short because it was loaded down with football plays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't make a mistake with Jim Tatum, I tell you.
Right. So tell me about joining the Advanced ROTC.
Well, in those days, you supposedly, in the land-grant school, you had to go through 2 years of basic ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And with veterans, they waived that.
Mm-hmm.
And you did not have to go to basic. But the ROTCs were booming so then. In our school, it was 2,200
mm-hmm.
in the ROTC Corps.
Wow.
And it was Air Force. It was Army for a while. I think it switched to the whole Air Force. But I went in the Air Force role only because it was $58 extra a month.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were doing, they waived the basic, and once we reached sophomore, and I guess they sure we were going to stay in school,
mm-hmm.
they tried to recruit us for advanced ROTC.
Okay.
The reason for that, they knew that we had a background in drilling and things like that, and we would require probably minimum instruction
mm-hmm.
to get a supervisor's role, if you mm-hmm. would call it that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started recruiting the ball players, and they were touting the $58 a month, and we were getting a small stipend. I think I got $125 a month, plus a GI Bill.
Right.
And so it sort of went along pretty good. And so I went into advanced ROTC and became, I think, a sergeant or something. I know I started drilling people the first day I was there,
mm-hmm.
and we were drilling the basics and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on through ROTC and up through the ranks, became a colonel before There was, I think, three colonels, and I was one of them in the school.
Okay.
And so I did quite well in ROTC, and that was sort of an incentive for me to stick with the service, you know.
How much did the GI Bill help you go to college?
Oh, God, if it wasn't for the GI Bill, I would have never gone, because the football scholarship was not that good, and I wasn't that good at football to be able to live through 4 years of football. I would have been out on the street after that sophomore year,
right.
I can tell that. But the GI Bill, if it had not been for that, I wouldn't have gone to college.
Because
I was really what they consider a walk-on.
Right.
I got a scholarship, but I didn't get it in my pocket until I got there.
Right. It sounds like you were a leader in the ROTC, that you took to it quite well.
Oh, yeah, I did. I enjoyed it, and I had some good instructors there. I had to give them a lot of credit. I remember mm-hmm. I remember them by name, too, you know, a mm-hmm. major in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, I enjoyed it, and I liked it. I didn't have any trouble with it at all. In fact, that was my straight A.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Now, this was the Air Corps, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, and you said you selected that simply because of the extra $58 a month?
Yeah, that was the $58 a month you got for being an advanced ROTC.
Okay. So when you get out of college, did you have a plan to go continue in the military, or were you looking
at private
business?
Yeah, I did. Well, they along about my junior year, mm-hmm. they started touting me for a distinguished military graduate, and I didn't even know what the hell that meant.
Mm-hmm.
And your grades had to be up there. My grades did get up there, as I said, after my sophomore year.
Mm-hmm.
And they started talking to me about distinguished military graduate. And if you made it through as a distinguished military graduate, you could get a regular commission.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing you get out of West Point, Annapolis.
Right.
And I, by the way, I had always wanted to go to Annapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And my father always wanted me to go to Annapolis. But my grades were never good enough to even talk about Annapolis.
Really?
But we were right there in Maryland, you know. We'd do some of our oystering that far up in the Severn River, really.
Right.
So I was really familiar with Annapolis. And I had another aunt and uncle that had a fire shop called Academy Fire Shop in Annapolis. So I was quite familiar with Annapolis. You school there all the time. I guess they were my role models, too.
Right.
But I, since I couldn't go to that, I went to ROTC instead.
Mm-hmm.
My father wasn't too pleased. My mother wasn't either. They knew that would mean leaving home or leaving the area. And they were, our family was quite large, and they were pretty tight together. I'm talking about the Trott family on my father's
mm-hmm.
side. My mother's family was very tight, too, but they were all down in Arkansas.
Right.
In Texas, Nacogdoches, Texas,
mm-hmm.
places like that.
Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about they were disappointed upon graduation that you would continue probably in the Air Force and that would, or the Air Corps, and that would take you away from them.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Well, I made a deal with the Air Force. You can't believe people trying to deal with the Air Force. That's how naive I was. I said I wouldn't accept my regular commission.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I could get an appointment to flying school.
Mm-hmm.
I had never flown in my life, you know.
Did you want to fly?
Yeah, well, I guess I did. And I just said that, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I'd be damned if I didn't get it. I got my commission on the 22nd of January, 1953.
Mm-hmm.
And, hell, I was in flying school by the 18th of February, 53. And they had a backlog of people getting into flying school then, you know.
Wow.
And they, well, I tell you, between you and I, the gatepost, how they got me in is they had seen my football record and all that, and they wanted me to play football at Bowling Field,
mm-hmm.
which is right there in Washington. They had quite a football team. And but I went to flying school instead. Anyhow, they thought if they gave me the flying school bit that I would stay and play
mm-hmm.
ball at Bowling Field. Well, the flying school assignment came through so quickly, and some of my instructors that I knew had moved from the University of Maryland to the Pentagon,
mm-hmm.
which is quite common, and they went into personnel, and one of the sergeants that I knew he made sure I got into pilot school in a hurry.
Okay.
So I went on down to Bartow, Florida,
mm-hmm.
and started pilot school there. Went from Bartow, Florida to, by the way, something unique, too, probably.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the first class of all commissioned officers. There were no cadets.
Okay.
And that's strange because they were not ready for this at a contract flying school because and so we ended up cleaning latrines and doing everything that cadets did.
Right.
And some of our guys resented that. I didn't because I had good training
mm-hmm.
in the Coast Guard, you
mm-hmm.
know. And so anyhow, I went on to flying school and got through that. Didn't have any problems. Started in Piper Cub. They called a PA-18. Got 25 hours in that. Went to a T-6. I think we got 120 hours in that. From T-6, then I transferred from Bartow, Florida, to a Air Force flying school, which is at Bryan, Texas, which was
right.
advanced.
Right.
And Bryan, I flew T-28s. in T-33s and got my wings on the, I think, the 23rd of February, if I remember, 1954.
Okay, so you were at Barton 53 to 54 and Bryan in 1954?
Yeah, well, I was at Bartow from 53 until, let's see, it's been 6 months. So about July of 53. Mm-hmm. Then I went to Bryan from July of 53 to, was in February. I received my wings, I think it was.
Okay.
And the 54, yeah.
Okay. Sir, why don't we take a break? I know you've got to make that appointment.
Okay, is it time?
Yes, sir.
Time flies. But it rings up here, and I can see it lets me have a determination of the workload.
Okay, sir. Why don't we go ahead and continue now? We left off with pilot training, basically at Bartow and Bryan. I wanted to ask you, what did it feel like for you to fly for the first time?
Oh, it was great because you anticipated for so long, you know, just the ground school.
Mm-hmm.
And then for me, having been in ROTC, advanced ROTC, I flew around, but I didn't fly the airplane, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But not any light airplanes, already sort of big stuff on trips and things.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'd flown a lot in the with the ball team, of course,
right.
Again, the airline. But as far as flying the airplane yourself, it was
right.
A real thrill. I remember the first time I took off. You solo in about 6 hours, and I was right on target there. I soloed in 6 hours, and
mm-hmm.
This was in a Piper Cub PA-18.
Mm-hmm.
I remember just shouting to the top of my voice as soon as I got off the ground, you know. Great success. You didn't think about how you were going to get back on.
What did you shout?
Just hooray or something, yippee or something like that. Uh-huh. I don't remember. I just remember doing it.
Uh-huh. You were excited.
Yeah, well, see, you really don't know when you're going to solo. The guy's riding in the back seat with you,
mm-hmm.
and then you'll be shooting landings or doing some kind of air work, and he'll come back and say, well, let's shoot some touch and goes or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you go and you land, you do a couple of landings, and he said, well, pull over to the side. Of course, you've never done it before, so you don't know the technique that he's going to use.
Right.
And he said, well, just taxi off the runway. So you taxi off down the end of the runway. He gets out. He said, it's all yours.
Wow.
You know, go do three landings. And, of course, he sits there and watches you.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that, and then it's all over.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then you do it. Well, then usually you fly with the instructor a little bit each day,
mm-hmm.
and then you go up and take the airplane yourself.
Did you have any memorable incidents that happened to you when you were training?
Let's see. I think about the 12-hour point, I had a guy came up. Of course, you've got to imagine around these little training bases how full the sky is.
Yes, sir.
And you always have to be looking out. I remember I had an instructor with me, thank heavens, and I got another guy named Leo Majors, played football for Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
He was in our class with us, and he came up under my wing and touched my wing, scared me to death.
Oh,
but he didn't even see me, never did see me. When we both got on the ground, the head instructor, he got us both together and trying to figure out what went wrong, and Leo didn't even know it hit me. And it didn't hurt the airplane, didn't do anything, but it sure scared the heck out of my instructor. I was
so
too dumb to be scared.
Well, were there any accidents that happened? Did everybody make it through training?
Let's see. We had no accidents in the... We had no accidents either flying school, but we had several people wash out.
Mm-hmm.
One of my best friends washed out, a guy by the name of John Cornelius, but he had migraine headaches,
mm-hmm.
and that's what caused him to wash out. He was mm-hmm. a good student. And I think we had one or two very weak students in both primary and advanced,
mm-hmm.
and that we, let's see, they didn't call it that. They called it basic and primary, I think, in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. But anyhow, we had one very weak student, but he got through and later became shot down three airplanes in Korea.
Mm. Wow.
You know, so he was, no, it wasn't in Korea, in Vietnam, I mean. Yeah,
Vietnam, okay.
And his name was Seth E. Tracy. We never thought Seth was good. He couldn't do hop, skip, and jumps, you know, and just a completely uncoordinated type guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he got through flying school and became a fighter pilot.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
And was instructing. And last I heard, he was down at Eglin, and he retired at the same time I did, school mm-hmm. colonel also.
Mm-hmm. What was the biggest difference between your basic at Bartow and your advanced at Bryan?
The biggest difference, of course, type of airplanes you're flying.
Uh-huh.
You find propeller-driven airplanes all the time at Bartow,
mm-hmm.
The Piper Cub, and then the T-6, which is a Texan T-6, mm-hmm. and that was a ground looping airplane. That thing was hard to land.
Really?
If you could land it, you like a lot of guys said, well, you can fly it, but don't try to land it, you know, mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it would just ground loop on you because it's a very, very narrow landing gear, mm-hmm. and it was a tail wheel, and once the tail dropped below your prop wash, that thing would go in any direction. So you had to stay with it, especially in a little crosswind or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then you went on to Brian. You got the T-28, which was a tricycle landing gear,
mm-hmm.
which is the first tricycle we had. And then that was a fairly powerful airplane, good aerobatic airplane. And you flew that for about, 60 hours, something like that. And then you went into the T-33, which is our first jet. And that was the big change, the jet.
Right.
Yeah, that was a big step forward. You become a man then.
How did you adapt to the jet?
No problem. I didn't have any problem. I didn't have any problem with instruments, and that's where most of the people had their problem.
Mm-hmm.
Instruments, some in aerobatics, some like that, but I had no problem in that whatsoever.
Sounds like you took to flying rather naturally.
Well, I wouldn't say that. A hell of a lot of study goes, pilots make a basic mistake of making people think it's easy, but it's not. You've got to stay with it.
Right.
You've got to really know what you're doing. A lot of studying involved. That was probably the biggest surprise to me, is the amount of studying, because I had not had a technical training whatsoever other than working on a lawnmower. I think my first car was a Model A, and my father made me overhaul it
mm-hmm.
before he let me drive it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only technical bit I'd had, because my prior service and my college and everything didn't open me up much technology at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So getting into the technical field, understanding the theory of flight and the jets and what made an airplane fly and all this stuff, and they send you to a propulsion school and engine school. Why, I don't know. I don't know that I ever applied any of it,
right.
even in my 28 years of flying.
Right.
But I guess it's stuff you have to know.
There's a lot of classroom time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're when you first start, I'm trying to think. I was trying to think of this one since our last phone call. I think that we spent, before we even flew, I think we spent something like 20 or 30 classroom hours, you know, because
mm-hmm.
usually you went to school in the morning or the afternoon, depending on what kind of schedule you were on.
Mm-hmm.
Then you flew the opposite time, you know,
okay.
and they alternated that. And before you started flying, those first 30 hours, you went continuously to ground school
mm-hmm.
and
okay.
And all that. So, but then you went to ground school half a day and you flew half a day.
Right.
Sometimes you'd go to ground school all day and then fly at night.
Okay. How was it flying at night? Was it?
Oh, it was interesting. It was interesting. People, the air is no different, really. But you can really get disoriented. I remember one time in flying school, I got really disoriented. We had of course, you're in Texas, you understand. We had a route that we were flying from Bryan to Austin,
mm-hmm.
up to Waco, and in turn and go back to Bryan. So a triangle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I took off, and they have instructors sitting at airports, and you're supposed to check in when you
mm-hmm.
go over an airport, you know. So there's about, I remember my call sign was Red Eye 39,
mm-hmm.
and so you're supposed to check in like Red Eye 39 over Austin, you know, at 2-3 after the hour, turning for Temple or Waco. And I remember I went to Austin, had no problem, turned, and then I went on up and I called over Waco, turning for Bryan. Well, I turned and started going, and I realized about 3 minutes or 4 minutes I had not turned over Waco. I had turned over Temple.
Okay.
Temple right there, Fort Hood, you know?
Right, yes.
All those lights and everything. And so I just turned the airplane around and got back on course,
mm-hmm.
came back over Temple, got back on course, went to Waco.
Mm-hmm.
So I called and said, this is Red Eye 39 over Waco at 2-6 or something like that. I'm turning for Bryan. And they said, wait a minute, you've already called in. You know, he wouldn't accept my position.
Oh, really?
So finally I had to admit it, you know,
uh-huh.
that I had called in over Temple
uh-huh.
by mistake, because that was a mark against me, you know.
Uh-huh.
They do everything. They're not trying to wash you out. They're just trying to make you better, you know.
Right.
But it was scared. I remember that scared me to death. I guess that was the only bad scare I had in flying school.
Okay.
Passed all my check rides and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was sort of embarrassed about that because that was nothing but a dead reckoning error. Mm-hmm. I could have gone strictly on time because there was no wind and we weren't flying that high. It was in a T-28, you know.
Were you by yourself?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was a solo. It's what they call a solo night cross country.
Okay. Okay. How were you doing with the military discipline and living in the military lifestyle? Were you still okay with that?
Nothing at all. No problem whatsoever. I enjoyed it. Well, let me put you this. I was married.
Okay.
And I was living off base. Yeah, I got married there as soon as I finished college.
Okay.
And was living off base. And of course, being in the class of all officers, it was a bit unusual, but I lived in a nice cottage up in Winter Haven when I was at Bartow.
Okay.
And then when we were at Bryan, we lived right out by Texas A&M.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Texas Aggies used to wake me up every morning and say, war song.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But there was no problem with I remember attending the bonfire after having a flying all afternoon, coming home real quick. My wife had been egg sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And so we jumped in the car and went out to the Aggie bonfire, which they don't have anymore.
Right.
As you know.
Right.
But in any case, no, there was no problem with the military discipline. Of course, I didn't have to live in a barracks or anything like
mm-hmm.
that, and none of us did. None of the officers did
mm-hmm.
in this one particular class. As I said, well, I was first class of all officers, unheard of. And the Air Force, the school at Bartow was a civilian contract school.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Bryan, we had military.
Right.
But they had a hard time getting used to an all-officers class because they didn't have anybody to beat over their butts, you know, anything
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there was not that much discipline there. We did march. We marched from classes and stuff like that. And we had commander's call and things like that. But as far as the military discipline, we weren't exposed to it like the cadet classes were.
Okay, okay. How would you rate the training you received there?
Excellent. Absolutely excellent.
Did it prepare you for what you would go to next?
Well, I guess so, but of course the war is being over and things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
Korean War ended,
mm-hmm.
and or had ended. And so they had us all in a pipeline to become fighter pilots.
Right.
We go out to Nellis, you know, and go to fighter school. So when it got time for me to go to Nellis, I was sent to Waco, Texas.
Okay.
Couldn't believe it, you know, very disappointed to fly navigator training. It was a navigator training base.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Waco, Texas, and started flying the latest transport airplane.
Hmm.
So I had to go to multi-engine school, really, which
okay.
I went to multi-engine school. I was going to go to Lubbock. I said I was stationed in Lubbock. I went to Lubbock, and the class was so overloaded because they were putting everyone into multi-engines. They were pulling people out of the fighter training.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Lubbock, and I think I stayed in Lubbock 2 months, and then they transferred me to Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
You know where Shepherd is?
Yes, sir.
Some Denton or someplace. And I went there, and I finished my multi-engine training there. And
okay.
I trained in... well, the airplane we trained in was the Martin, the B-25.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the B-25, I got my multi-engine rating, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to Waco and went into T-29s, which was a Convair flying classroom, twin engine.
Mm-hmm.
And then flew that at Waco. Boy, let me see. I flew that thing. I went to Waco, got there finally in 54. About the summer of 54, and I left there in 58.
Okay.
And during that time, I was flying. Of course, I tell you, you have to imagine that there just wasn't much flying done. The Air Force was cutting back. In fact, we were losing a lot of officers,
mm-hmm.
The reduction in forces and things like that. I remember some of our best pilots we lost right in flying school at Bryan.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of reduction forces. I don't know their background. Maybe they didn't have good records. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, they were, most of us are ROTC grads. Well, all of them were, I guess.
Right.
Anyhow, or no, we had some OCS guys, by the way. But anyhow, we lost, I'd say, maybe five. I remember it well. This was a reduction in forces. And so people were worried. And anyhow, when I got to Waco, I started looking for what we call additional duties.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked up an additional duty. One of the guys in the squadron, in my flying squadron, he said, well, why don't you go? They need somebody over the staff judge advocate's office, additional duty, working with administrative boards.
Mm-hmm.
And hell, I didn't know anything about that. So I went over there, and I became an administrative board assistant, JAG, Judge Advocate General's Office.
Mm-hmm.
And And what I did is administered, and this is, as I say, we were having a rift, and they were having all kinds of administrative boards trying to get rid of people, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not only officers, it was enlisted men, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you wrote one bad check, you were on your way out, you know, stuff like that. And so I ran those administrative boards because they didn't want to use the lawyers to do that. You know, it was such a, it was a routine thing. I remember the regulations even, 3910 and 3912
mm-hmm.
were the two regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And they were administrative regulations where you recommended, it wasn't a court-martial, but you recommended the person be given an administrative discharge.
Okay.
And I guess I did in about a year or maybe so there. Let's see, yeah, it had to be a year. Maybe it was a little longer than a year because I guess we discharged about all 23 people. I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a busy time for the
mm-hmm.
for that office. Of course, the administration of that thing was just unbelievable. And you had a hearing just like a court-martial and
mm-hmm.
all that, a board of officers, I think three-officer board. And I went to went to squadron officer school out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only TDY, so I went down to Maxwell. That was in 1955. I think it was in 55C.
Mm-hmm.
Squadron officer school, and then came back to Waco and stayed at Waco for maybe 3 or 4 months
mm-hmm.
after that. And then I became itchy, if you want to put it that way. Got tired of that administrative law business. And Waco, as I said, was a navigator training base.
Mm-hmm.
And about that time, Kurt LeMay was head of SAC, and SAC was reaching its ebb, I guess. And Kurt LeMay came to the requirement that all of his aircraft commanders in B-47s had to be navigator bombardiers as well.
Okay.
So I applied for that, and lo and behold, I got it.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to navigator school right there at Waco.
Really?
Yeah, and in 6 months got my navigator and bombardier rating. That was they set up a special class for... Or they call it LeMay's boys,
mm-hmm.
and special class for to make pilots and the navigators. Of course, you didn't have to go through dead reckoning. The main thing was celestial and then learning how to work the radar bomb sites and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Okay.
So I graduated there. I guess I got my navigator's wings. Well, I know exactly. 1958. Mm-hmm. It was about February of 58. And then from there, I went to El Paso, Texas.
Okay. What rank were you at this point?
Oh, God, let's see. I was a second lieutenant for 18 months. No, I think I suffered because of the reduction force. I think I stayed a second lieutenant for 2 years. Everybody else was making 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And they just were cutting back, so they said they'd hold up our class. I know all of us are pissed off about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I stayed a second lieutenant for 2 years, so that would have made it 56. And that was about the time, let's see, I was the first lieutenant. Yeah, that was about the time I went to, so that'd been about right, I went to Biggs as the first lieutenant.
Okay, so at El Paso, what did you do there?
Well, okay, I went on, well, the first thing I did was I became on a crew of a B-36.
Okay.
And that was very disappointing, disheartening. You know?
Well,
I was one of a 26-man crew.
It's almost like you went, wow, that's a lot. It's like you went from, you know, this potential fighter pilot all the
yeah.
way down to
oh, yeah,
a
yeah,
crew.
Oh, yeah, 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 that's very tough, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I always heard about the needs of the service, you know,
mm-hmm.
type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, then I went to the number 26 on the 26-man crew is what I called it.
Okay.
And there were about five pilots. And two engineers and the rest of, I mean, rated engineers, you know, commissioned engineers
mm-hmm.
in those days. And then about maybe 10 or 12 enlisted people in the airplane. We'd go up and fly missions 14, 15, 20 hours, you know.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
What were your specific duties on board?
I was the third pilot, to
okay.
tell you the truth. And my specific duties were making sure we had the flight lunches. And making sure that the parachutes are all there. You became an equipment logistics officer is what it amounted to.
Right.
And then every once in a while they let you in the seat if you straighten the level. But as far as takeoff and landing, you sat in between the pilots, you know.
Okay.
You didn't. And of course, I had no training in that airplane whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just right out of flying school, really, as far
mm-hmm.
as they were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I guess I had. Now, one thing I didn't say, when I was flying the T-29,
mm-hmm.
the missions were quite lengthy,
mm-hmm.
and I built up 2,000 hours flying time first 2 years out of flying school,
wow.
which was unheard of. Mm-hmm. And, of course, everything in the Air Force goes on flying time, especially if you're going to go into SAC or military with
right.
or something like that. So by the time I got the Biggs, I had 2,000 hours flying time. And went to B-36 as third pilot, which was really degrading. But anyhow, mm-hmm. I didn't stay there. I didn't even check out the airplane. Mm-hmm. And then I was picked up by a, what they call a senior crew, a select crew, in B-47s. And that's what I was trained for.
Okay.
But I became a co-pilot on a select crew, which meant the aircraft commander and the navigator mm-hmm. Had spot promotions. One was a lieutenant colonel, another was a major, mm-hmm. and they weren't much older than I was, to tell you the truth.
Really?
But they'd been in SAC for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and they this was under the LeMay's bit. And if you did something right, he'd give you a promotion right on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, I went on as a second lieutenant. I'm a first lieutenant as co-pilot on the crew. And there were not many select crews. Once they had ready, they had lead crews, and had the top thing was select crew, and then lead crew, and then a regular crew, I guess. But anyhow, I went on select crew, which was quite an honor to be picked to go on that.
Right.
Because the hardest thing was staying on the damn thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, because these guys are tough. You know, they ran it for the money, I said.
Really?
And both of them were career guys.
Okay.
A guy by the name of Bop was the, and he was a major. And then the aircraft commander was Clem Latimer, and he was a lieutenant colonel.
Was this still in 1958?
Yeah, this was in 58.
Okay.
Right, 58.
How long did you do this?
Well, I stayed with them, well, golly, let's see, 58. Yeah, it had to be 58. I stayed with them, and we were both transferred. Well, they closed Biggs for about a year because they were putting a new keel in the runway, so they could bring B-52s in there.
Mm-hmm.
So they've transferred the B-47s and we got transferred. The select crews got to pick their place they wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And both of these guys are from New England. So they picked Pease. I didn't even have a choice. You know?
Right.
They picked Pease, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which mm-hmm. is since closed. And we went up there and stayed there 7 years.
Really?
Yeah. And that was in SAC, training in SAC. I picked up my own crew in 1960.
Okay,
and
what, you became pilot then?
But that, I went from co-pilot to aircraft commander.
Okay, to commander.
Yeah, and then picked up my own crew in 1960 at Pease.
And you stayed there until 65?
I stayed there till 65. That's right.
Okay, what were your duties? What where would you fly? What would you do?
Well, I was in Strategic Air Command,
mm-hmm.
and we had assigned targets, and we would go on alert. And we'd go to, on reflex, we called it, over to England and Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd sit over there with weapons in the Bombay, and we would be ready to go back. Some of the time, we had to have the whole fleet off the ground in 11 minutes.
Right.
Because that was the time it'd take to get the missiles supposedly to us. You know.
Right.
And our duty was mainly training, target study, mm-hmm. and flying practice missions.
Mm-hmm.
And then, actually, we would go from Pease to England, and we'd stay over there 90 days, and we'd be on alert for, we'd be on alert for a week and off a week, and then home for a week and off a week. And while we were off, we had pretty good R&R stations. We'd go to Denmark, we'd go to Spain, we'd go down to Mallorca and the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
Because I tell you, when you got in SAC and you really started minding your P's and Q's, nothing was too good.
Mm-hmm.
For the SAC crews, you could have a C-47,
mm-hmm.
and it'd fly you all over Europe, go any place you wanted to go.
Really?
And the senior crew usually picked the place they wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I wasn't a senior crew by then, but when I was on with the other crew and we were going over there, man, we used to go some great places.
What did your wife accompany you overseas?
No.
Okay.
She stayed here and started having children.
Okay.
Yeah, we were peas when the first child. No, yeah. No, we were in El Paso, first child was born.
Okay.
And then the second child was born at Pease.
Okay. Now, were you carrying nuclear weapons?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I don't know. It bothered me, but, it was a war on. We were hired killers, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, part of our training was go through nuclear delivery training there at Wichita, Kansas, I think it was. And, of course, you learn all about it. You see all kind of pictures of Hiroshima, I guess, and Nagasaki, and then all the testing, and you had to learn the theory of nuclear weapons and hydrogen weapons and stuff like that, which, I tell you, is not an easy course, again, for a non-technical guy.
Right.
But they, and the testing in that was unbelievable. Of course, the testing in SAC was not so much. Once you learned the weapon and went to weapons delivery school and learned the weapons and all the characteristics they expect you to know about the weapons, because the Kurt LeMay would actually personally question you on him when he'd come. But the biggest thing in SAC was the positive control testing. And it was 100% required. You could not make a mistake.
Really?
And if you, well, like when we were on the crew with the select crew, these guys had spot promotions, they would actually sweat going on alert because you had to take this positive control test every time you went on alert.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be like 20 questions, and you couldn't make a mistake at all.
What kind of questions?
If you did, if you made a mistake, you would lose your spot promotion right on the spot.
Wow.
And so it was money to them. Of course, I didn't have as much to. And of course, the hardest thing for the co-pilot was actually, in my opinion, was the we had to handle all the jamming of all the radar, you know. And our main problem was being able to identify which jammers to turn on. And they had trainers that were just mock-ups, you know, that you set in the classroom, and they'd play these tapes to you. And you, by the sound, you had to know which jammer to turn on. They had mock-up jammer control boxes there, and they would play the tape, and then they'd look and see which one we turned on.
Right.
And Kurt LeMay would get upset if you made a mistake on that, too.
Mm-hmm.
But so that was the that sort of sidelight to fly an airplane. You know?
Right.
And so that was the I think the biggest challenge was the testing in order to maintain your favorable status in eyes of Strategic Air Command people, you know. So they were really strict. There was just no room for error. But now back to the question about what did I think about nuclear weapons.
Yes, sir.
I don't know. You sort of become numb, and you only hope that the diplomats are right. That's the same thing I'm thinking right now with this thing over in Iraq, you know, all these things they're saying and everything. And we were truly in a mode of deterrence, and we were over there, and we would the closest I ever came to really being scared, this is after I had my own crew back in 61 at Torrejón, no, at the, not Torrejón, Morón, down around, oh, I forget, Marseille, no, I'm trying to think of the name of the town. But anyhow, it was down on the coast of Spain, right off there at off the Mediterranean. We received an alert, you know, all the horns went off.
Right.
And I remember we were playing softball or something. And we all had alert vehicles. Each crew had their own vehicle because you might be any place on the base, you know. And we received an alert, and we jumped in the vehicle, went to the airplane. And the normal procedure was the navigator went up first. The pilot went up second. The co-pilot stayed down, make sure all the ground power was removed, you know. We wouldn't drag a fire cart with you. But anyhow, I came up the ladder. And the navigator was screaming, this is what he was on the interphone, put on your helmet, put on your helmet, we've got a go message. God, do you think that doesn't make you pucker?
Right.
But and we had it. It was a go message. Of course, you have, under the positive control system, you had three people that had to you know, match cards and all that.
Right.
So we had to wait for the co-pilot to come up. Well, in the interim, I put on my helmet now just to try to, we were starting the engines, because this was a place where you only had about 11 minutes to get the whole fleet off. There was 28 of us. And we were cranking engines. Co-pilot came up, put his helmet on. We all copied the message down. It was a go message. And so we just were resolved to go, you know. So we taxied out. I think I taxied out about number three. Of course, it's 28 airplanes. Just a big mass of airplanes taxing out. We had set procedures on taxing out and taking off and all that. And we turned onto the runway, and fire trucks were across the runway. They'd made a mistake in the message center, and they pulled fire trucks through. That's the only way they could stop us. Because the particular message we had received, there was no recall associated with it.
Right.
So they pulled fire trucks. In fact, the wing commander's car was out there, too.
Really?
They were blocking. They blocked us. They wouldn't let us take off.
That's really close.
That is close as hell. And what had happened on that, it later appeared in Reader's Digest, some geese had flown across the dew line up there in Greenland and set this thing off. And every SAC airplane in Europe, and this is in England and Spain primarily, it may have been some down in Morocco at that time, I'm not sure, but we're under the same thing. And we just scared us all to death. So that was as close as I came to really getting scared with about nuclear weapons.
It's kind of scary that geese might set off a nuclear exchange.
That's right. You're so true. Mm-hmm. So true. And the only safeguard was a fire engine. Because the particular message they sent out, we had different types, and this particular message that we received to our command post was kind of we had no recall.
Mm-hmm.
There are some messages you could go up and go to what they call the positive control point.
Right.
And if you didn't get further message, you had to turn around or go into an alternate base.
Now, did your crew have a specific target set up?
What was
your target?
I can't tell you yet, I don't think.
Really?
I don't know. It was all classified then. But it was in Russia.
Okay, so it was a city in Russia that...
Oh, yeah, it was a town, yeah.
Okay, and so your specific plane was targeted just to that town the whole time?
Well, no. That was part of the study. We'd get over there, we'd have to study a target, and sometime you get the same one,
mm-hmm.
and sometime you wouldn't. There were thousands.
Okay, so it was random.
Well, they try to put us on the same one.
Okay.
But it just depends on what the war plan was.
Okay.
But we had different routes, different headings. And mm-hmm. In fact, some of our targets were so close to our takeoff site, we'd have to take off and circle.
Really?
In order to make timing, you know.
Wow.
After altitude. And some of them we even had to... it was so far away, we had to pick up a tanker en route,
mm-hmm.
and in many of them, we had to pick up a tanker coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, I know that damn tanker wasn't going to be there coming out. You know?
Uh-huh.
But we had alternate places to, we had what they call safe havens
right.
to land in, and we had addresses that we could go to and knock on the door
really?
In some place, and they were supposed to know we were coming. But
uh-huh.
I don't know if that ever worked or not.
So how far did you ever get to your targets? I mean, was that the one you just
That's
described?
The only time. Never took off. No.
Okay.
No, I never took off with weapons down. Of course, the B-52s in those days were actually airborne. They had
right.
airborne alert, and they were airborne, and they were going over their positive control points and just holding over there.
Right.
Sometimes hours.
Now, have you seen the movie Dr. Strangelove?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think about that?
Oh, that's just a typical Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
Typical Hollywood.
Not very accurate?
No, it's not very accurate, and the I think the emotion associated with it was not that great. We I guess by the time you work yourself up the ladder to that position, you become fairly professional.
Right.
I guess you'd have to say.
On board the plane, you mean?
Yeah.
Right.
And I don't think there was any way it could happen. There were so many safeguards. That's the reason they made sure three people had to agree
mm-hmm.
on the positive control message.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had all kinds of authentication mechanisms and of course, all three of us knew the combination. See, it was a safe on each airplane.
Right.
And they knew the combination.
Right.
So, but it was pretty well thought out. That guy LeMay was smart as hell, even though he used to scare people to death. I remember he came in after I got my crew, and that was a big thing. You know, if when you were, before you could take a target or actually going to work, say you arrived in, well, let's use Torrejon in Spain, you arrived in Spain on a Friday night,
mm-hmm.
and you did not assume your target till Sunday, and that gave you all day Saturday to rest and target study, and then you had to brief that target before the other people were relieved off that target.
Right.
You had to brief it. Well, you didn't know who was going to be in that briefing. Normally, it was the wing commander over there
mm-hmm.
and at Torrejon, or it could be somebody from 5th Air Force or usually the wing commander was a full colonel,
mm-hmm.
and or it could be some general coming in from SAC headquarters or from the I think it was 8th Air Force headquarters over in England,
mm-hmm.
and they'd come in and take the briefing and stuff like that, and or it could be Colonel LeMay, and I briefed LeMay one time.
Did you really?
Oh yeah, God, it was now you're talking about being scared.
Why were you guys so intimidated by him?
Well, because he could just do anything to you. You could be relieved right then. You could get a bad OER and never get promoted again.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just hell on wheels.
The mm-hmm.
only thing he wanted was results.
Right.
Because I remember the B-47, I don't know if you know it or not, but it had wing tanks that you actually pulled a explosive charge, and these tanks were slung underneath the wing,
mm-hmm.
like big bombs, really.
Right.
And they held 510 gallons. I remember them well. And you would burn those right if you took off and go into your target. And then when you got rid of those, the war plan, because it's a wartime only, you would jettison your wing tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And that would allow you to go faster, of course, cut out weight on that. And so, you know, I had this parachute came out and jerked off. And you, of course, you never practice this. You know,
mm-hmm.
So anyhow, I was going, and he asked me what point, you know, we were briefing, you have a map on that, and we were briefing it with my pointer, and went to point, this is the point where I eject, the wing tank should be empty, and we object, he checked the wing tank.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I was a captain then, by then, I think. He said, Captain Trot, what would you do if the wing tank didn't come up? Did the parachute open and the thing just held there?
This is LeMay.
Yeah, Kurt LeMay.
Uh-huh.
And, God, I'd never had this question, never been asked in ground school, never been discussed by anybody
right.
that I knew of.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, the max speed on the airplane is 4 1/4. I'd say, I think I'd nose it over and go to 4 1/4 and blow them off.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you're exactly right, you're now a major.
Really?
Yeah, that's just the way the guy operated.
Just on the spot, you were promoted.
Just on the spot, right there.
Wow.
And I stayed major. Well, I stayed major, never lost a spot,
mm-hmm.
and stayed major then. So, you know, it's sort of crazy, but that's the way it worked.
That's
and that's why you feared a guy. That's one of the reasons, you know, because
mm-hmm.
this much, if I'd made the wrong answer, he said, get the hell out of here. I don't want to see you again.
Right.
Or something like
I
that.
I see what you mean.
And he'd done that before.
Really?
In fact, he would come on bases, and this is stories. Now, I've never been on a base where he did this. And the wing commander, you know, a colonel,
mm-hmm.
would have made a mistake or something had happened, and he would come on base with the new replacement commander and tell the wing commander to be off base by sundown.
Wow.
And that's just the way it was.
Wow.
So, okay, let's go from there.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question. What were you doing in 1962 during the missile crisis?
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was stationed at Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, I had my own crew, yeah, because I picked up a crew there in 60.
Mm-hmm.
We loaded 4 Mark 28 weapons on board, and we loaded the 80 on board, which is a rack of rockets back on the back of the airplane,
mm-hmm.
and which you're supposed to fire to take off in order to take off with a heavy load in a shorter runway.
Mm-hmm.
And then those rockets, you eject those at P's out over the water. But we loaded those on, and we took off.
You had nuclear weapons on?
Oh, yeah, 4.
Okay.
Took off.
How many did you say?
4.
4 of them. Okay.
4 Mark 28s.
Mm-hmm.
Mark 28 was about, let's see, it was about 10 megatons, I think.
Oh.
It's about 1,000 times bigger than what had been on Hiroshima.
Mm.
And if you can imagine that, we had 4 of them. And we took off from Pease with the 80 racks on. This has never been done, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
With the 80 racks on. And, well, they had been taken off of them on. But then we landed at Logan Field in Boston
mm-hmm.
with a damn 80 racks on. We didn't know if it was going to work or not, but
mm-hmm.
it did. And we landed. We sat there. Let's see. We landed, refueled, and we... He brought a car out there, a van, and we sat there in that van for 4 or 5 days.
Wow. What were your orders?
I had a target. I had a target. Of course, those were targets in Russia. The idea was that we would be dispersed. They wanted to move the
mm-hmm.
airplanes
right.
and disperse them.
Right.
And that's what they did. Now, we didn't go very far. We went from Portsmouth, New Hampshire to Boston,
mm-hmm.
which is only 53 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's what I did. I think there were 4 or 5 other airplanes. We had a total at Pease of, let's see, we had a total at Pease of about 40 B-47s
mm-hmm.
and about 25 KC-97 tankers.
Okay.
And the tankers were dispersed, too.
Okay.
So I sat there for the entire Cuban crisis, and I remember... They came with equipment and downloaded the weapons, I think, and they downloaded the 80 rack first, and it took them 2 more days to decide what to do with the weapons, but they didn't want us to fly them back. So they downloaded the weapons and carried them over land,
mm-hmm.
and we took the airplane back.
Okay. How did you think the president did during that crisis?
I don't know. So many rumors and things, and the only thing we were involved in is waiting for a go message. We knew we were going to get it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about the adrenaline flowing, man, it really flows.
But so what did you tell your wife about this? I mean, that okay,
well,
if I get the go message, that means we're at war.
Well, see, that was the thing. None of us talked about that. That was all so damn classified.
Okay.
And we know, I talk about it now, you know.
Right, of course.
But in those days, it was so classified, you didn't talk about it to anybody, wife or not.
What did they tell you about the classification system? Did they say, okay, here, you know, if it's top secret, then you can't talk about it with anybody, or was there another level?
It was top secret, and it was one more. We had I had a crypto clearance. That's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
We had to have a crypto clearance to utilize some of the code books that we had on board.
Mm-hmm.
And, you didn't talk to anybody about it, you know.
What did they tell you what happened to you if you did?
Well, court-martial.
Right.
You know, they didn't have to tell you. You knew.
Right.
You know,
you'd be out of
it. But implied, yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, back to 1965.
Okay.
By this time, the United States had become involved in Southeast Asia and Vietnam pretty heavily,
mm-hmm.
getting there. What did you follow? What did you know about what the United States was trying to do in Southeast Asia at this time?
Well, let's see. They started, it started about 62, didn't it?
Well, our involvement, yes.
Yeah.
Directly.
Well, the only thing I remember is the the gunboats or something down there in the Tonkin Gulf thing. I remember that. And them sending some people over there as advisors, I think it was called.
Yes, sir.
And I thought we were just going over there. I do remember Dien Bien Phu with the French. I can go back to there. And I remember they got the hell beat out of them and moved out. And then I felt that we were going to fill the vacuum. I guess that's what I was thinking.
Right.
And I guess we tried to.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember... Let's see. Of course, I wasn't in that side of the country. All our interest was over into the Soviet Union. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really, other than the nightly news, you know, and sitting in the alert building with my crew listening to the news, I would just think we were just in there going to go in there and, I guess, clean the place out type
right.
thing.
Right.
You know, and we'd see these guys fighting in these jungles and stuff like that, how difficult it was, how hot it was, and I didn't like snakes, and I didn't want anything to do with it. I did get it later, but go ahead.
Well,
but that was my first thing. Of course, in SAC, we were sort of, at that time, removed from all that.
Right.
Not ever thinking that B-52s or Arc Light or anything like that would start.
Right, right.
And never thinking that I'd get into the Agent Orange business, you know. I was
right.
kind of... six-engine jet bomber.
Right. You did not think he'd be flying spray missions over...
Yeah,
over...
didn't know what it was.
Right, right. Well, did you follow foreign policy in general? Were you
yeah, I did. As I said earlier, my interest was in history.
Right.
And my degree, my bachelor's degree, was in political science.
Okay.
And I had a lot of people there at Maryland who were really good. They had all kinds of connections there. In the Washington area with State Department, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, George Shultz, I don't remember him or not.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the Secretaries of State.
Yes,
he was one of our instructors.
Really?
We had another guy by the name of Steinmeier, who had been a judge at the Nuremberg Trials. Yeah,
really?
I think Nuremberg Trials, and he was one of our instructors.
Hmm.
So I became very, I guess, embedded in foreign policy and was very interested in that. And kept up with as much as I could.
What did you think of the United States mission during the Cold War, this anti-communist mission?
Well, the containment concept under Truman during Korea and stuff like that, I thought it was very good. I think we made a mistake you know, I had mixed emotions when they relieved MacArthur, for instance,
right.
and things like that. In fact, I wasn't even in college then, I don't think. Maybe I was working, because I remember... MacArthur coming back to Washington.
I think you were at Maryland at that point.
Yeah, probably was. And I was probably working at the store in the summertime or something.
Because
I remember when he came to Washington and made that great speech about old soldiers don't die, they just fade away.
Right.
I think I saw that on television at our store.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you're right, I was at Maryland then probably. But, no, I thought the containment concept was very good.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that, that Truman... did the only thing he could do in the MacArthur situation.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I would think now that was correct.
Right.
He may have been wrong, but he did what he had to do
right.
to maintain our constitutional control rather than let the military take over. Of course, my thesis, my master's degree thesis, was civilian control of the military. That
really?
Was the title.
Well, tell me about that. What do you think of civilian control of the military? Because we're going to talk about Vietnam, and that there's a big controversy about that.
I think that it's a fine line, and it's something that you really have to think through. And it's difficult for the civilian to attain the same outlook that a military person has attained.
Mm-hmm.
And however, we've got some real smart people in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll cover later in the Pentagon, work with some of these people. I was just amazed at guys like Harold Brown and Will McNamara, as far as that goes,
mm-hmm.
just how brilliant they were and how those guys didn't forget a thing, and they didn't miss a thing either
mm-hmm.
in briefings. And you could come back and brief them a year later, and if you brief something different, they say, well, you told me this last time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether he had a copy of a talking paper or what.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of Harold Brown. He was extremely knowledgeable guy
mm-hmm.
and brilliant. And, of course, a lot of those guys are attorneys and have good minds. And of course, they had tremendous staffs, too.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't give the staffs enough credit either.
That's right.
But I feel that we have no choice the way we're set up, but to we have to condone, if you will, control of the military by the civilians. And I think that we would be in trouble if we didn't do it. But I think it's up to the military to make sure that that civilian in that position gets all the options.
Right.
And some assistance in deciding which option to take.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that you got guys like this guy Frank, I don't even know him at all, down in Tampa,
mm-hmm.
and then you had Schwarzkopf and the Desert Storm and all that,
mm-hmm.
and I had a son over there in that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, I think those military guys are almost as smart as those civilian guys,
mm-hmm.
but it's their duty, the military duty, to make sure that civilian guy who's really going to have to put the stamp on it knows what the hell he's doing.
Right.
And if he doesn't, if the civilian guy doesn't know what he's doing, then he's either not listening to the military guy or the military guy is not advising him properly.
Mm-hmm.
So I still believe in civilian control of the military.
Okay.
You just read my thesis.
Well,
I didn't have Schwarzkopf or Franks in it, though.
Right, right. Well, okay, so in 1965, you left New England. Where did you go from there?
Okay, I went to Command Staff College.
Okay.
The B-47 was mothballed or, you know, scrapped mm-hmm. or something, because I flew about the second from the last one out to Davis Monthan, to the Boneyard. Oh, you're talking about crying. I was almost crying when I saw that.
Were you really?
Yeah, yeah. I'd been with that airplane so long. Not only, I always managed to get an additional duty, and I became a maintenance officer,
mm-hmm.
a maintenance control officer, really ran a job control
mm-hmm.
facility at Pease, and knew the airplane very well.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it didn't have much technical background, but I seemed to fall into the maintenance logistics side of the house,
mm-hmm.
only because I didn't mind working long hours, I guess. But anyhow, I took the last, or the next to last airplane, I think, from Pease anyhow,
mm-hmm.
out to Davis Monthan, and they're just lined up. I didn't get them to see, cut any of them up. They've already cut them all up by now,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't get to see that, but I knew what was going to happen.
Right.
And then I thought I was going to go stay in SAC, and I thought I was going to go, I had orders, in fact, to the Airborne Command Post,
mm-hmm.
Looking Glass. I just thought of that name, Looking
mm-hmm.
Glass.
Mm-hmm.
And thought I was going to go to Omaha. Had my furniture all packed and ready to go, and I got orders changed. I went to Command Staff College at Maxwell
okay.
for a year, and that's where I picked up my master's degree.
Okay, this is 65, 66?
Yeah, picked up my master's degree in 66, right.
Okay. Did anything significant happen there at Maxwell that you think we should talk about?
No. In those days, you still had to fly, so I think I flew B-25s and Goonie Birds.
Okay.
No, I flew B-25s at Squadron Officer School, and then I flew Goonie Birds. Well, hell, they made me instructor B-25s because I'd been flying B-25s when I went through multi-engine school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came here, and I found out I'd flown a B-25. They made me an instructor. I couldn't believe it. But anyhow, of course, you only flew 4, 5, 6 hours a month.
And that's just to keep your flying hours.
Yeah, those days you had to fly in order to get paid that month.
Right.
When you fly and pay. And then when I went back in 65,
mm-hmm.
I flew Goonie Birds because I think I flew Goonie Birds. Yeah, I flew Goonie Birds. And because I'd flown multi-engines again,
mm-hmm.
and he checked me out in the Goonie Bird. Of course, that's a year tour, command and staff was, so
right.
he had plenty of time. And nothing ever happened there. I'm trying to think. had some excellent classmates. That's a sort of an exchange program.
Yes,
you
sir.
Have Navy guys, you have guys from overseas, and had some excellent classmates in there, especially my seminar. Went out on a carrier, got to see a carrier operation for 2 days out of Pensacola, and one of the LSO's landing ship officers, landing signal officers, rather, he happened to be in my seminar, so he took us, the nine guys in the seminar, and just took us from stem to stern on that carrier.
Wow.
It was I'll never forget, it was the Yorktown.
Really?
The Yorktown down display someplace, you know. Wow. It was an old World War II carrier.
Yes, sir.
But nothing exciting, except the only excitement I had is, hell, you didn't know where you were going to go out of command and staff college. Thought sure I'd go back to B-52s and SAC or to Looking Glass or someplace like that. And lo and behold, from command and staff college, I went to the Pentagon.
Okay.
And
did you request that, or did they put you there?
No, I didn't request it. Let's see, how the hell did that happen? Okay, I know. The guy who was a division commander at Pease, a guy by the name of Jack Catton, C-A-T-T-O-N, he left Pease. He was a one-star at Pease. He got his second star and went to the Pentagon as the Deputy Chief of Staff of Programs and Resources.
Okay.
And he came down to Command and Staff College and interviewed several people to go into a new job at the Pentagon. And I remember he interviewed me, and nothing else was said. And then I thought, as I said, he asked me where I was going to go. I said, you know, General, I'm going back to SAC. I've been in SAC all my life, you know. And he said, we'll see, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I knew, I had orders to, and worked for him in the Pentagon.
Okay, were you still a major at this point?
Let's see. Yeah, I guess I was. I went to Pentagon's major, yeah.
Okay. How long were you at the Pentagon?
2 years.
2 years to 68.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
Can you describe what you did there?
Yeah, okay, at the Pentagon. I laugh at the job because it's just crazy as hell.
Mm-hmm.
But it was I was a manpower utilization analyst. That was the job description.
Okay.
And my job, and it was a special unit that this Jack Catton had set up. And our job in that division, it came under manpower, of course, was to determine the maintenance manpower requirements for a 10-year life cycle of a weapon system.
Okay.
And one of the weapon systems I was assigned, only because I had the clearance and all this, and this is what Jack Catton was looking for when he was briefing us, interviewing us down at Command Staff College, was the Blackbird, the SR-71.
Right.
I got right in on the ground tour.
Did you really?
Yeah. I was making the manpower. I was determined the manpower was going to take us to maintain that airplane before we had the first airplane on the runway.
Wow.
You think that wasn't a joke? All you did is you had to go out and look at other airplanes. Of course, in the aviation business, in the maintenance business, you have a factor that's called maintenance man hour per flying hour.
Mm-hmm.
And you have those for every airplane. And you take these and you figure out how much flying hour you're going to get on the airframe.
Mm-hmm.
And your total airframe inventory, then you multiply that by the maintenance manpower per flying hour, and then you come up with your maintenance manpower.
Okay.
You multiply this by 10 years, you come up with 10-year maintenance manpower. And the problem is when you get a new airplane, new weapon system, doesn't be an airplane, a missile or anything. We had a lot of missiles coming into the program then. And you had nothing to go by. And so you went out and found an airplane that you thought was as close to that airplane as you possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
The one we used was the B-58. I don't know if you're familiar with the B-58 or not.
I've seen pictures, yes, sir.
Yeah, it's a Delta Wing four-engine jet bomber that SAC used. And the damn thing, well, it was not supersonic, but it was right on the borderline.
Mm-hmm.
So we took the B-58 and we multiplied by five, factor of five, and that was the figures we used SR-71.
Okay.
And we missed it by 500%.
By 500%?
Yeah. That's the reason I never went back to SAC.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I tell you, General Catton protected me. He really did. But that was a fluke. In fact, the guy that's my was my boss at the Pentagon, a lieutenant colonel at that time, most brilliant guy I'd ever worked for, is now one of my constituents here in Highlands.
Really?
Yeah, Bill Bathurst. And he and I worked together. Bill's and very, he was non-rated. He was a professional statistician. And he was the one that General Catton put in charge of that.
Okay.
And that's the guy I worked for in the Pentagon. But they put me on this Blackbird assignment, me and another guy, a non-rated engineer, really, who kept me out of trouble a lot. And we would leave the Pentagon on Sunday afternoon, I think I get this right, fly to San Francisco, rent a car, and drive to Marysville. I mean, you know where Marysville is or not?
No, sir, I don't.
That's where the bird was. That's close to the Skunk Works.
Okay.
And that's where they were getting the birds and getting them out of the crate. And all the thing that ate the airplane up on maintenance van after flying iron was all the ground support equipment. And, of course, the airplane, when we were looking at blueprints and things like that, had all these holes in it. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't even tell us what was going to go in the holes.
Really?
Yeah, and so how the hell did you figure out the maintenance? We knew the engine was going to be complex as hell. But we didn't know what all the other... all these infrared and all that stuff we'd never heard of before.
Didn't you have clearance to see that?
Oh, yeah,
that?
We did, but they wouldn't tell you. Hmm. They didn't give a damn what your clearance was.
Huh.
And really, I don't think they knew.
Really?
I don't think some of this stuff had been perfected.
Huh.
And they were making holes in an airplane hoping that they'd get something to go in. That's what we used to say. But anyhow, we missed that thing. And I didn't discover this, that how far we'd missed it. Until I was out of the Pentagon. Because after I'd been there 2 years, I picked up a couple other programs, one of which was the branch hand program, and how much that thing was going to cost. And I picked up that program, became very interested. Another program I had there was called Sacred Goat. You never heard of that, have you?
No, sir.
Okay, Sacred Goat was McNamara had discovered a bunch of 10,000-pound bombs left over from World War II. And the theory was, know what I said, theory, was to mount these things on pallets and put them in C-130s, open the rear door and roll them out, and have the fuse set up where they go off about 20 feet above the ground.
Okay.
That would clear out the forest.
Okay.
And helicopters would come in and land.
Okay.
And it worked. It worked. I worked that program for 2 years. It was in operation when I started there. And I picked up that program and then picked up the Agent Orange program, which is both together because it was working for the Army, clearing out these forest things.
And this is while you were at the Pentagon?
Yes.
Just after?
Okay. Yes, this is at the Pentagon.
That's okay.
When I was working. And, of course, I became interested in Agent Orange or came interested in the ranch hand. We didn't think about Agent Orange.
Right.
Because they weren't using Agent Orange at that time. They were using Purple, we called it then. And it was that stuff was really toxic. But, again, we didn't know it until we got over there. But, anyhow... I was working one of those three programs. Blackbird, spending most of the time. We'd go out on Sunday. I didn't finish that. Go to Marysville, stay there all week, come back on Friday night, brief General Catton, Dr. Brown, and several other people on Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say Saturday morning. We'd start our briefing cycle at about 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, and we usually get to the general level by 1.
Wow.
Because you have to go through the staff, you know, the
right.
chain of command. Bill Bathurst being one of them. And he was the worst one of the bunch. We got it by him. We could stay alone and get home early. And we go home about 4 or 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon.
Wow.
Sometime 9 or 10, and then leave on Sunday afternoon. So it wasn't much family life there.
I can imagine.
And I had three children by then, I think. Mm. Yeah. No, two children by then. No, three. Three by then. Third one was born at Walter Reed, yeah.
Okay.
And I was gone almost all the time. So I remember my boy was just, he was in about sixth grade by then.
What can you tell me about the SR-71? What did you think of that?
Oh, well, that was just a mystery airplane. It was a good airplane. I had the opportunity to meet, what's the guy's name? It was the guy that really perfected that. It was a Lockheed guy, ran the skunk, Kelly Johnson.
Kelly Johnson.
I got a chance to meet him, and of course, he interviewed us before we started the program. He said, well, let me tell you guys, I don't know what it's going to cost to maintain it, but I was only told two things. They wanted to fly high and fast. In other words, it had no maintainability built into it. When we first started on it, they had to raise the wing, actually take the wing off to change an engine.
Wow.
And the engines cost about $3.5 million.
Each?
They each, you know, they had two of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you had a flame out in flight, it was almost impossible to do an air start.
Hmm.
And we lost a lot of airplanes to that because they lose all their power and all mm-hmm. that stuff. And I sat there and watched one of them run off the end of the runway on a taxi test because the brake chute didn't work.
Hmm.
Lost the plane. Did not lose the pilot. Just had a test pilot in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw we had two of them crash. One of them over very much similar to this shuttle that went up. It mm-hmm. started breaking up over Dallas.
Yes, sir.
And we picked up parts out of New Mexico.
Hmm.
Yeah, it just there was one before that, a B-58. The same area. That area right there is really a snake pit
mm-hmm.
over in the Dallas area where we just had this shuttle disaster.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, the SR-71 was a great airplane. It was a man killer as far as crew is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It was a electronics nightmare. I remember sitting in the staff car at the end of the runway after we'd get the thing all started, you know, and of course the pilot had to be in a pressure suit and he had to be in a pressure chamber
right.
about 4 hours before he went to the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And they put him in there, and then they taxi out, and the damn navigational system would go out or something like that. So he taxied back in, he pulled the pilot out, pulled the nav equipment out, and put the pilot back in the pressure chamber, but you were 24 hours late getting takeoff and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a maintenance nightmare as far as that's concerned. And
right.
it was a crew nightmare, too.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of friends who've been in the U-2 program went to that airplane.
Really?
And but they were, most of them had been former test pilots. They were, most of them were somewhat similar to your astronauts now.
Mm-hmm.
They had just unbelievable criteria for the crews, as the navigator as well as the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it was a great airplane. I really enjoyed it. We had a lot of problems that required common sense. I remember one of the ones I saw personally
mm-hmm.
was they were having all kinds of braking problems. So they would do the classification. They would tax it right into a hangar,
mm-hmm.
and we had all kinds of fires, brake fires. So we started parking it in front of the hangar, and you won't believe this, in taking two electric fans and sitting on by the landing gear, cooling the brakes off. $20 million.
And that's how it.
And that solved the brake problem.
$50 million aircraft.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's with two electric fans. I said Sears and Roebuck fans, but they're probably more expensive than that.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember I saw them in the hangars out there. I said, well, hell, let's put those things on the brakes.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at me, and where are you going to do it? I said, park the thing right in front of the hangar, get a damn long extension cord, and put those fans out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, hell, I wasn't an engineer or anything, so I was proud of that one.
And
we did stop that, but, of course, the security officers went crazy.
Because,
mm-hmm. see, they wanted to put those things right in the hangars.
Right.
They wanted them covered because we knew our friends overseas had all kinds of satellites
mm-hmm.
going over.
Mm-hmm. Right. By this time, what did you think of the Vietnam War? It's raging, 65, 66, 67,
well,
68.
I became interested in it because they kept putting more and more demand on Agent Orange airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
We were taking C-123s that we'd been in training. They'd been in cargo, short-lift cargo, we called it, and they were trying to figure out ways to make it work, and they were putting a 10,000-gallon tank in it and the spray bars under the wing, spray bars under the fuselage, and then just about that time they decided to put an auxiliary jet engine out on each wing,
mm-hmm.
and that's when they called it the KC-123.
Mm-hmm.
That's for the jet engine. And the reason for the jet engines is we were spraying 40 feet above the trees
mm-hmm.
and up there in the north part around Da Nang and everything and all the mountains. We call it the mountain ranch. And you get down in those valleys, and, boy, sometimes you couldn't get out.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen, the crew would start climbing out way before he came to the end of his run. You couldn't blame the guy. It was the only way he could get out, you know. And so his spray would be totally ineffective within about maybe a quarter of a mile from the end of his run.
Mm-hmm.
It would still be green. And what you did, you waited 6 days, 6 to 7 days,
mm-hmm.
and you went in there in a FAC airplane to look to see the effectiveness of the herbicide.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had striping, like if they weren't finding their formation properly, you would get striping. They'd
mm-hmm.
have to go in and do it again. And that's really when you got your butt shot, is when you went in over an area that you'd already sprayed.
Right.
Because most of the leaves are gone. Those little rascals sitting there
mm-hmm.
right by the tree, and they've got those AK-47s right on you. And that's
mm-hmm.
when I got one. But
mm-hmm.
anyhow, that... the war in Vietnam was really beginning to boom. The Army was screaming for more and more chemicals, herbicide, to increase their horizontal visibility in those jungles.
Mm-hmm.
And we were getting in deeper and deeper. And that's when I went to General Catton. And well, I went to him twice to get my papers to go to Vietnam. He said, hell, you don't even know your way around the Pentagon yet, you know, stuff like that. Of course, I said, well, you don't ever let me stay here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But anyhow.
And why did you volunteer to go over?
Because I just felt it. Well, the other thing I hear, I felt very guilty of having working all these programs for Vietnam, Sacred Goat, the herbicide,
mm-hmm.
and several other programs, and not having been there, you
right.
know. And here I am, these guys coming back from over there, we bring them into the Pentagon, and we try to debrief them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Guys like Jack Spade, is that?
Yes, sir.
Camille?
Yes, sir.
Jack Spade, he was our lead guy in Ranch Hand. And another guy, what the hell is his name? He became a general. He was retired in Arkansas. Can't remember. I'd get my old Ranch Hand papers out, I would. But anyhow, he would come in and he'd debrief us on techniques and what the airplane needed. In fact, it was those guys coming back that got us to put the jet on the wingtips.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Of course, that was you're talking about a Rube Goldberg. Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
We put that thing out there, and there's no throttles involved. You had two toggle switches on the overhead panel. You just reached up, turned the toggle switches on, damn jets went on.
Really?
You know, you had no control.
Gotcha, boost.
There you go. You got a hell of a boost. And
mm-hmm.
we'd use them sometime on takeoff.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, when we came up with the problem, one of the problems I remember, it was either Jack or this other, Russ. Yeah. I'm getting old. I can't remember. Russ somebody.
Mm-hmm.
He came back, and their problem was they'd come into the land,
mm-hmm.
they'd reverse the props, and all that dirt would go up that jet engine.
Right.
So
right.
we had to get a lens that closed and hooked into the prop mechanism. As soon as you reverse the props, this door shutter
mm-hmm.
closed on the intake of the jet engine.
Mm-hmm.
And that solved that. But we pulled our hair out. To,
mm-hmm.
Well, maybe it probably took us 2 or 3 or 6 months to figure that one out.
Now, how did you feel about, I understand what you said about volunteering, but how did you feel about going into a war zone?
It didn't bother me, I don't think, too much. Well, after I got over there, I found that the damn mortars were more troublesome than the airplanes. You
mm-hmm.
know, I got mortared several times.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Benoit, right north of Saigon,
mm-hmm.
and we received 3 or 4 or 5 mortar attacks at night there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a major when I went over there. Yeah, a major lieutenant colonel while I was over there. And anyhow, I was still a major over there. No, maybe I was a lieutenant colonel, I don't know, because I made major back in, hell, 60. I made major. I don't know, I guess I was still a major when I went over there.
Okay.
We only talk about 68, and I made major in 62, I think,
mm-hmm.
something like that. Okay, so anyhow, the mortar attacks bothered me more. After I got over there, I didn't think about the mortar attacks, but those are more dangerous
mm-hmm.
than flying, and the type flying we were doing. Although we'd get a lot of hits, and we wore body armor that you wouldn't believe.
Mm-hmm.
Our body armor weighed 54 pounds.
Wow.
And we'd only put it on. We kept it back of the airplane, and we were going to the target. Before we went down on the target, we'd go back in the airplane, take turns, put our armor on, and come back up.
Mm-hmm.
So then we had armor helmets, too.
Mm-hmm.
And we really... The only thing, and the seats were armored. The only place that wasn't armored were our balls.
Mm-hmm.
And that scared us to death because you couldn't armor that because you had to pull the yoke back.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of a U shape in the seat, so it'd give you clearance to pull the yoke back in case you had to.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do, our checklist was about maybe 4 inches thick of plastic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so after we finished reading the checklist, we'd take that and stick it down under the ball. That was that armor. Everybody did it, I tell you. And I got a hit. I guess I'd been over there 6-7 months, and I got a hit right in the chest. It came right through the instrument panel, AK-47. Fortunately, that armor, thank God for Corning, because
mm-hmm.
it's made by Corning Wear.
Mm-hmm.
And who, by the way, the president of Corning, is a retired president of Corning, lives here in one of our country clubs.
Really?
And I keep kidding him. It's Pat Moore.
Mm-hmm.
I keep kidding him that he saved my life. You know? Of course, I kid him. He's head of our Performing Arts Center and stuff like that.
Okay.
But anyhow.
How did your wife feel about you going over?
I think she was very upset.
Really?
She was very upset. When I was stationed at Pentagon, we were there in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I had bought a house in Washington right across the street from where I was raised,
mm-hmm.
and which was good for me. My kids were all going to school. Well, two kids were going to school. Ellen was still an infant. And she was very upset. And of course, we were, as I say, we were living in Washington. And before I went down to Hurlburt for training, by the way, we didn't say anything about that training for Ranch Hand, but that was an excellent training.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, let me tell you. Before I went down there, we were sitting in our house one night, and mm-hmm. her brother was an electrical engineer. He worked for NASA, in fact. And he, I had an old TV, and I wanted him to look at it because he could fix anything. And I was going to take it with me to Hurlburt, and we just determined the thing was no good, so we wrapped the cord around it and set it on the floor by the door.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, my daughter, who then, I guess, was about 12 years old, she was playing with a little girl next door. She came in about 6 o'clock, and this was in September, and she left the door. The next thing we knew, two black guys were in our living room with guns in our face.
Really?
Yeah, this is a good section in Washington, right about 6 blocks from the National Cathedral.
Oh my gosh.
And just about scared me to death. Of course, made us lay on the floor. Fortunately, it didn't hurt anybody. They went up and ransacked the house. And they said they were with guns and money. We didn't have either one. And they left. They took that TV that wasn't any good. And they took our big TV. They just wrapped their arms around it. Too big. And they later found them. But I was over there worried about them, you know. Of course. Went out and bought a German Shepherd and all that crap. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, I was worried about them. I was worried about them. I wasn't over there worried about them. I was down at Hurlburt, and that's what you want to go to, talking about the training for ranch hand.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, that's at Hurlburt Field, mm-hmm. which is Eglin number 9, mm-hmm. Auxiliary Field number 9, down at Destin, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, that was here. Remember, I've been flying six-engine jet bombers, you know,
yes, sir.
And all that. And then here I go back to two-engine mm-hmm. airplanes. They didn't have the K model in training either. It didn't have jets on. But what we did is the main thing and the most difficult thing to learn for an old B-47 guy who closest he'd been to an airplane is 17 feet 3 inches,
mm-hmm.
and that's refueling, you know, was formation with that and the techniques that Jack Spey, by the way, had developed
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam in spring. And, of course, our instructors at Hurlburt were mostly old crop dusters down in Florida, which they had mm-hmm. a lot of them.
Okay.
And they were teaching us actually crop dusting techniques, and it's a very different technique. You fly an echelon, and you turn into the echelon, which drives a fighter pilot crazy because they never turn into the echelon.
Mm-hmm.
But you turn.
Can you describe what you mean by that?
Okay, echelon is a staggered formation,
right?
And you have everything to your left,
mm-hmm.
and you. The normal way would be to turn to your right,
mm-hmm.
and but the problem is with the radius of turn, the other airplanes could never stay with you.
Okay,
you follow me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so what you do in a 123, you've got to remember you're only going 140.
Mm-hmm.
You turn to your left. If you're in an echelon to the left, you turn to your left. You turn into that airplane,
mm-hmm.
and man, that scares the hell out of a fighter pilot. But what you do, he turns right there on you,
mm-hmm.
and you maintain the same radius, if you can imagine this,
mm-hmm.
and your formation stays together. You continue to spray, and you have no striping in between the spray runs.
Right.
But I tell you, it scares the hell out of fighter pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of our supervisors in Vietnam were all fighter pilots, and they would fly over us in A-10s and stuff like that and see what we were doing. And I've had my ass chewed so many times, I became the operations officer over there for a while. And they would bring me down to Tansanute and just chew my butt about our techniques.
Really?
And I'd take them up and show them.
Mm-hmm.
And it still scared the hell out of them.
You know? This is stuff that you perfected at Hurlburt?
Yeah, this was perfected. Well, it was perfected at Hurlburt
mm-hmm.
with these spray pilots. And really, Jack Spey and Russ, damn, I can't remember that Russ last name, but anyhow, they perfected it over there
mm-hmm.
because they were using real spray and they were seeing the results of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were seeing the results of turning away from the formation,
right?
Which just didn't work. You just wasted half of your load, really,
mm-hmm.
depending on what your turn was, how big you were working. Of course, you only had a 4-minute load in that 10,000-gallon tank,
mm-hmm.
and you that was the length of your spray run. So if you had a short run and you wanted to turn, you wanted to spray while you're running, you had to turn into that echelon. And it, as I say, it just scared the fighter pilots to death. But it worked. It was very successful. Mm-hmm. We had a hard time explaining it to them.
How did you adapt to flying the 123s versus all these other airplanes that you had flown?
Well, the 123 is a piece of cake. And the reason we chose that, and I wasn't in on the ground floor of the choosing. They'd already done that when I got to Pentagon. Mm-hmm. But no power controls whatsoever. Everything controlled by a little quarter-inch cable.
Hmm.
And you think of anybody that's unlucky enough to have a AK-47 pierce a quarter-inch cable, mm-hmm. probably shouldn't live anyhow.
Right.
You know? But that was the beauty of it. Plus the design of the airplane, the fuel tanks were not in the fuselage.
Mm-hmm.
They were not in the wings. They were aft of the engine in a nacelle.
Mm-hmm.
And that engine protected that fuel tank. Plus, there were self-sealing fuel tanks, too. And so they had a rubber lining in there.
Mm-hmm.
After you got shot in the fuel tank, you could still fly, if I remember correctly, another 15 hours before that rubber would get to your carburetor.
Wow.
That's what they were worried about. So you could. We actually put two or three missions after we had the tanks pierced.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I flew 145 combat missions over there,
mm-hmm.
and did it on that year I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Took a week R&R, 6 days R&R, went back to Hawaii. My wife came over. Let's see. I think she brought two of the kids, left one of the kids, the youngest, I guess, with my mother, I think. Yeah, one of them was born in 66, so she went brought that. And we had a great time in Hawaii
mm-hmm.
at Bellows, which is on the north side. And I went back and finished my tour.
Now, was there anything else at Hurlburt that, was there anything that happened there that you definitely used specifically in Vietnam?
Well, I tell you, there's a technique, and I'm sure some of the other ranching guys will tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot use your altimeter flying at 40 feet above the trees.
Right.
And what you had to do, and this was a major part of the training there, was learn how to determine your altitude, your height, really,
mm-hmm.
By the flow at which the trees went underneath the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most difficult part.
How did you get to do that? Was it just practice?
Yeah, practice, practice, practice. We flew every damn day. We'd have some ground school, but we'd fly sometimes in the morning and in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it was very limited night flying. And we just had to learn it. That's all. The other mm-hmm. technique that was different, the co-pilot flew, now I'll get this right now, the co-pilot flew the throttles.
Mm-hmm.
The pilot, the guy in the left seat, flew the ailerons, in other words, the yoke.
Okay.
And that was to maintain the formation. And the co-pilot was on the throttles, and he was the only guy looking straight ahead. And if he saw a tree that moved up on the windshield, he'd mm-hmm. add the power.
Okay.
As long as that tree was moving down on the windshield, you're all right. You're going to clear it.
Right.
Follow me?
Right.
And if it didn't move at all, he had to add the power, too. Mm-hmm. So that required a lot of teamwork. Mm-hmm. I had a young co-pilot, Jack Tebay, who was Air Force Academy graduate, one of the best in the business, but I never could check him out as a pilot.
Really?
Because I became the ops officer later, and he could handle the throttles good, but I don't know what. I think he was trying too hard. Being an Air Force Academy graduate, you know,
mm-hmm.
they think they're like doctors. They never make their first mistake. You know? And those guys are over-motivated.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some guys we never could check out. We had some older fellows who couldn't check out. My main job after becoming the ops officer is keeping people from jumping on the airplane. I've never seen a more motivated group of people in my life.
Really?
Yeah, these people wanted to fly all the time. And I'm talking about guys 45, 48 years old, master's mm-hmm. degree. We were that unit, and I may not be right anymore, but at one time had the highest number of graduate degrees of any unit in Vietnam.
Hmm.
And I think that was around 1968. See, I went in training in 68, got over there in December of 68,
mm-hmm.
and came back in December of 69.
Okay.
Let me tell you what this Master Sergeant did for me.
Okay.
I raised hell. This is Chief Master Sergeant Personnel at the Pentagon. I got to know real well,
mm-hmm.
and he found out I was going to Vietnam, and, of course, I had to go to training in September. And he said, I'll get you a good assignment time, a good port time, he called it. And so he did. It was the 13th of December. I raised hell. I missed Christmas with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I called him. I said, what the hell are you doing to me? He said, go and have Christmas a week or so early with your kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but you'll appreciate it. And I went over there on the 13th of December. I got back on the 1st of the next December. Did you really? I was back there for Christmas with my kids.
Right, that's great.
And that's the advantage of making friends with some of these old old sergeants. You know, they can carry you on.
Why was there such high morale in the ranch hand spray missions?
One of them was the commander at that time was a lieutenant colonel Stoner. What was his first name? He had a brother over there too, but this guy was completely crazy. I've never seen a guy with more adrenaline, and he just wanted to go out and get hit, you know.
Really?
And he was a big old overweight. He walked with a limp. Ken Stoner was his name. He was a used car dealer at Fayetteville, North Carolina.
And died
of a heart attack after Vietnam. But he was just a motivated guy. He motivated people like you've never heard, and we scared people to death. We'd have our commanders, like our wing commander would be over at Phan Rang, and he was what we called a trash hauler. The other 123s, you know, didn't spray. And they'd come over and they'd ride with us. And they'd ride one time and we'd never see them again. One of the guys' name was Campbell. And the other guy was named Paulie, by the way. Jane Paulie's father.
Really?
Yeah, you know the Jane Paulie on,
yes, sir.
On television. Her father. And he became a, I guess after Vietnam, he became about a 3 or 4 star.
Mm-hmm.
And he became the sink of the Army, not the Army, the Air Force in Europe.
Okay.
I think he was 4-star. No, he was Army. No, he wasn't. He was Air Force. He had to be a wing commander. And Paulie was his name. John Paulie, I think, was the first name.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a jewel of a guy and looked just like she does.
Really?
Yeah. Beautiful person.
Hmm.
But the morale, I think, was really derived the fact that we were doing something different.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing something everybody thought was crazy as hell.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a few people that wouldn't go. We had some shell-shocked people. And we had one navigator, remember, who was a great navigator, and he would just malinger like anything. He'd be sick, and he'd be this, and he'd be that. And I couldn't get him on a flight.
Really?
But that was, I think I had, of the 6 months, or I guess 5 months, that I was the ops officer, I guess only 2 people that I couldn't get on an airplane. There were some I wouldn't let go. You know, I'd make him an administrative officer or something like that.
Right.
Because I just felt as though they didn't weren't capable. One old guy, he was 49 years old, Jim Martin.
Mm-hmm.
We called him Pappy. And he was right in the same hooch with me, but I just wouldn't let that guy go because I knew he was going to bust his butt.
Mm-hmm.
And he would fly airplanes up to the depot to get them modified. Our depot was in Hong Kong, and which wasn't a bad deal.
Right.
And he would fly them up there, and we'd have to send them up there every 6 months they went up there. And, of course, we always kept an airplane up there, so I had him. He was sort of my shuttle guy, you know.
Right.
And he was good, but I wouldn't put him on a spray run.
What about the morale of the other American troops that you were around? What could you comment about that?
Well, I got a chance later on in the last 6 months when I became operations officer. We had to go around to as I said, with the Army chemical people and to brief these province chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty surprised that these guys lived out there in all this dirt and mud and dust, and we would find these short fields, you know, in the 123s there, and then getting helicopters. I thought their morale was great, considering what the – I wouldn't want to be living in those conditions. You know,
right.
One of them was Song Bay, sticks in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I left there one afternoon about 3 o'clock. It was overrun that night, and every American in there was killed.
Wow.
But I can't believe the morale – of that bunch that day.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, the problem with Vietnam, these hooch maids and these people that are working for you during the day,
yes, sir,
were the enemy at night.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't even throw our flashlight batteries away. We'd take them out and run over with the Jeep. Because the story was, of course, this is rumor, that those flashlight batteries end up in a rocket and be launched back that night on your base.
Right.
You know, use them. And your watches. You got wristwatches. Boy, you watch those like a hawk. Because they somehow hooked those up as a timing device on those damn rockets. That was a story. I don't know if it's true or not.
Mm-hmm.
But we would watch our wristwatches and stuff like that, especially flashlight batteries.
Right, right. Sir, why don't we go and take a break for today? I know it's after 5 o'clock here.
Yeah, it is. My wife is probably going to wonder why I'm not home.
Okay.
But I told her I was going to be talking to you until about 5.
Okay, we're going to end it for today then.
Okay.